Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Tomorrow marks the one-year anniversary of President Obama's election. During his first year in office, he's been faced with a wide range of issues, including a massive financial and economic crisis, a heated healthcare reform debate, and pressing global issues. Juan Cole, professor of Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan, argues that the president campaigned on an ambitious platform of withdrawing from Iraq, engaging Iran on its nuclear program, and persuading the Pakistani government to take on the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. In a recent Salon article, Professor Cole writes, quote, "You'd never know it from the mainstream media, but Obama deserves high grades for his work so far in Iraq, Iran, and Pakistan." Professor Cole writes about the Middle East on his blog Informed Comment, and he joins us from his office in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hi, Professor Cole. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose.
Nice to have you. We are also joined by Harry Kreisler, Executive Director of the Institute of International Studies at UC Berkeley and Executive Producer and host of Conversations with History. His new book, Political Awakenings, will be published by the New Press in March. Hi, Professor Kreisler. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Nice to have you.
Thank you.
And I want to let listeners know that Professor Cole will be with us until 30 after. So if you'd like to join us, we're going to be talking about his article about President Obama's foreign policy record, specifically on the Middle East. Professor Cole focuses on Iran, Iraq, and Pakistan. Do you agree with Professor Cole that President Obama deserves high grades? What do you think of his foreign policy record so far? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. 798-8255. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Professor Cole, first off, what sparked this article, and why did you decide to focus on Iran, Iraq, and Pakistan?
Well, those are the areas that Obama has actually achieved something in so far. And the article was sparked by a feeling that these are stories that the corporate media is missing. So just for instance, and it's also sparked by my email correspondence with my weblog readers. I have this Informed Comment blog, and people write me. People kept writing that Obama's policies in Iraq were indistinguishable from those of Bush. And it's just not true. When Obama took office, there were 142,000 troops in Iraq, and they were actively patrolling Iraqi cities, taking casualties, attracting fire, apparently. Their presence was causing a certain amount of the trouble. And the 2008 budget for the Afghanistan-Iraq wars was $180 billion. As we speak, the troops are down to less than 120,000 on their way to 112 by January 1st. They're no longer patrolling. The Iraqi army is now in control of the country to the extent that it's in control. And the budget this year is $150 billion. So, you know, if you had a headline, Obama brings 22,000 troops out of Iraq, cuts war spending by $30 billion, that'd be dramatic. We're ahead of schedule in withdrawing from Iraq. You know, it is true that the Iraqi parliament forced Bush into this timeline, but Obama is ahead of the timeline, and Obama actively campaigned for the timeline before the election. So, if you think that being in Iraq is a mistake, then Obama is doing a good job so far.
Well, you mentioned the comments on your blog, Informed Comment, and I checked out the comments on the article you wrote at Salon, Obama's Foreign Policy Report Card, and a number of people pointed out, and I'd love for you to respond to this, that there are still 58 bases in Iraq, 150,000 contractors. And then some people also argue that one of the reasons for the decline in violence is because of the forced population transfer along sectarian and ethnic lines. And also, the walls, some of the walls have come down, but so many of the neighborhoods are divided by walls.
Well, the way I would respond to those criticisms is simply to say that Obama pointed out that, you know, the United States government is a supertanker, and you can't turn a supertanker around on a dime. It takes a while to make a 180-degree turn. The question is not, you know, are there still troops in Iraq? There are bases. Obviously, if there are troops in Iraq, they're going to have bases that they're on. The question is not whether there are leftover policies like the blast walls, which the U.S. is, by the way, no longer in control of. The Iraqi government decides whether those blast walls stay up or not, and has taken a lot down. But what I'm saying is that Obama is ahead of where anyone said we would be with regard to a U.S. withdrawal by this point. And those bases are being turned over one by one to the Iraqi military. There's every prospect that in a year and a half there will be no U.S. troops to speak of in Iraq. So to say that Obama is accomplishing nothing in Iraq is just not right.
Professor Kreisler, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think there's an element of truth in what's being said by Professor Cole. I think whenever one wants to comment on President Obama and what he's doing, you just have to recall what a god-awful mess he was presented with, both in domestic issues, international finance, and on foreign policy. And so what we have is brilliant president who I think knows all of the issues and has just been a very difficult situation, so that in choosing to withdraw from Iraq and moving in that direction in the course of the campaign and then now as president, he made the point that the real war, the war of necessity, was in Afghanistan, and that led him to make a very early decision, putting an additional 20,000 troops in Afghanistan. So I think I can't fault what Professor Cole is saying. I just think that these problems are so big, they're so intertwined, that it's hard to make a final judgment. And I would just point out that I believe Professor Cole has pointed out in the past that the U.S. really has to address the political situation in Iraq. I fear that Obama, in some of his decisions, for example, my preference for ambassador to Iraq would have been General Zinni. General Zinni is a man who understands politics and military issues, but in the course of the choice of the ambassador, there was a scramble for who would go there, and Zinni was left out in the cold. And now my understanding is we have a situation where our commander there is not talking to our ambassador. So I think if you look narrowly at the promise and you look narrowly at what the voters were asking for, there is truth in what Professor Cole is saying. It's just the question of the broader picture.
And Professor Cole, we spoke with a journalist on Friday who was based in Baghdad, talking about just the occupation and just the significance of so many troops still being in Baghdad. Because we noticed that in many articles, when you look at the violence that is still happening, there's really no mention of the American presence there.
Well, the American troops are no longer doing independent urban patrols. This is what I'm saying. There's been an enormous change on the ground in Iraq that nobody seems to be noticing, which is, as of June 30th, the U.S. military is not patrolling the major cities of Iraq, and indeed cannot do so unless the Iraqi army actively invites them to do a joint patrol. Those invitations were expected by General Odierno. They haven't come. And these are Iraqi officers that were trained by the U.S. military. So when you talk about an occupation, it's no longer the case that if you're in Baghdad, you open your window and you see U.S. patrol going by. It just doesn't happen. And in fact, there's a problem with the troops that do remain, and one of the reasons that I think Odierno has changed his mind about dragging his feet on the withdrawal is that they have very little to do. They appear to be kind of confined to base. I don't deny there are U.S. troops in Iraq, but they are not actively patrolling anymore, and can't do so unless the Iraqi government asks them to do it, and they're not asking. So I don't entirely understand the objection. And what I'm saying is that this is night and day from what Bush wanted. Bush came into those status of forces agreements last year asking for U.S. military control of Iraqi land, sea, and air, for the ability of the U.S. to arrest anybody anytime on any grounds, to hold them without charges, and so on and so forth. And the Iraqi parliament, and I think the Obama campaign, both pressured Bush into a very different situation.
Oh, let's go to a caller. Let's hear from Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Yes, Professor Kaur. I was quite shocked. I had no idea that you were that politically conservative. And I was just reading about Wikipedia, and if you come from a military family and that you are a strong believer in the Baha'i faith, which I thought was a pacifist faith, it seems to me you're also neglecting Barack Obama's disastrous failure to really stand firm with the Israeli government about settlements, and the fact that he's reduced these troops while increasing troops in Afghanistan. I just see him as being Bush light. I really fail to see the validity of your argument here, and I was curious as to what brought about this change in your thinking, if in fact it is a change in your thinking.
Okay, thank you, Harry. Professor Cole?
Well, I don't entirely understand the caller's comment, which, by the way, was full of inaccuracies. But the fact is that whether somebody's conservative or liberal or left would depend upon the standpoint of the speaker, obviously, from the point of view of a Trotskyite, I'm a flaming right-winger. But I don't think that in an American political context anybody would accuse me of being right. I presume the caller wants the U.S. military out of Iraq. What I am saying is Obama is ahead of schedule in getting the U.S. military out of Iraq. So this it baffles me that the fringe American left can't get this through its head, that what it wants most dearly in the world, an end to U.S. Occupation of Iraq, is also Obama's policy, and that he is doing better with it than we had any right to expect at this point in time. With regard to the other issues that are raised, my article is not about Afghanistan, and it's not about the Israel-Palestine issue, because I gave Obama incompletes on those. We don't know exactly what's going to happen there. Hmm. But we do know we have some actual outcomes in Pakistan and in Iran and Iraq.
We actually got a few emails on Israel and Palestine also, wanting to know what you thought of his policy there so far.
I think we'll all be little old people rocking on our porches, and there will still be bad news from that part of the world.
Well, do you have any comments on Hillary Clinton's recent visit to Israel?
You know, here is just a bad fate written in the stars. Ariel Sharon had broken with the Likud party and decided that a two-state solution was the only way to keep Israel from being overwhelmed by Palestinian residents. And Bush wasn't interested. Bush, according to one of his cabinet officials, said, let there be some conflict. Conflict sometimes clarifies things. So I guess things are clear now. Now Obama comes in, and his team wants a two-state solution, and it's got Bibi Netanyahu and Avigdor Lieberman as the Israeli government. And as the most right-wing, most expansionist, most hardline government in Israel's history, they're going to drag their feet and undermine the peace process, and they've already defeated Obama on the issue of further settlements and so forth.
And Professor Cole, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. We're talking about President Obama's foreign policy record so far. You can also send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Professor Cole will be with us for about 10 more minutes, so now would be a good time to call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, San Francisco, 91.7. Your local public radio station is 20 after 11. Coming up at noon, it's Philosophy Talk. The topic this week, healthcare, right or privilege. At 1 o'clock, Are We Alone? Science Radio for Thinking Species. And at 2 o'clock, World of Ideas on the Forum from the BBC World Service, right here at 91.7 KALW. Stay tuned.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, Sandeep Roy will have a conversation about the upcoming climate conference in Copenhagen. What are the key commitments the U.S. must make if we're going to slow down global warming? And will President Obama even show up to Copenhagen? There's some talk that he's not going because the U.S. will not have an environmental bill in hand. That's tomorrow. We'll be joined by Jim Ayers, the vice president of Oceana. And then on Thursday, Breast Cancer Awareness Month was in October. How much do we know about where all of the money that's raised during Breast Cancer Awareness Month actually goes? What is it spent on? And do these pink ribbon campaigns actually help? That's on Thursday. If you have a show idea for us or an overall comment, you can drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation about President Obama's foreign policy record so far, you can drop us an email or give us a call at 866-798-8255. What do you think of his foreign policy record so far? And do you agree with Professor Wong Cole that President Obama deserves high grades for his work in Iran, Iraq, and Pakistan? Professor Cole teaches Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan. He also blogs at Informed Comment. We're also joined by Harry Kreisler, Executive Director of the Institute of International Studies at UC Berkeley, author of the forthcoming book, Political Awakenings. And again, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Professor Cole has to leave us in about 8 minutes. Professor Cole, did you want to finish your thought there? You were just talking about Israel and Palestine. You say that you're giving it an incomplete so far.
Well, no, I think it's
or giving Obama an incomplete
to the other subjects, and I wanted to say something about Pakistan.
Sure.
During the Bush administration, the United States gave the Pakistani military dictatorship about $11 billion, supposedly to fight the war on terror. They appear to have mostly spent this money on arming themselves to confront India. And then a little bit of it seems to have been spent on encouraging the Taliban. So the Pakistani military took us for suckers. And Bush let them do it, gladly. And Obama came into office determined that the shell game was going to stop, that the Pakistani military was going to have to own the problem of the Pakistani Taliban, that there was going to be accountability in the aid, and they're going to shift the aid to civilian aid rather than so much military aid, which was frankly being wasted and stolen or spent on war preparation for a war we don't want to happen with India. So Obama and his team put enormous pressure on the Pakistani government. So the Congress has now passed and Obama has signed a $7.5 billion civilian aid program. That's what everybody wanted, is that we would do, you know, people won't have to go to madrasas or Muslim seminaries if they have civil schools to go to. We're going to encourage Pakistanis to build more of those, and so forth. And there's a provision in the law, which was very controversial in Pakistan, that the aid will be in part dependent on the Pakistani government being able to report back that it the civilians, are in control of the Pakistani military. With regard to the Taliban, when Obama came into office soon thereafter in February, the Pakistani military and the civilian government both more or less turned over the Swat Valley to the Pakistani Taliban to let them impose their very odd, rigid interpretation of Muslim law. And, you know, they were beating girls and oppressing people. And I think, on this station and elsewhere in the country, there was dismay at this sort of surrender to the Pakistani Taliban on the part of Islamabad. And Obama convinced the government to send in security forces and take on the Taliban and liberate the people of Swat from their oppressive rule. And that was very successful. It did displace a lot of people temporarily. They're back in their homes now, and the Swatis that I talked to and the Pakistani public in general seems to have been just delighted at this turn of events. And, of course, the Pakistani military is now taking on the hardline Pakistani Taliban in South Waziristan, and they're actually finding evidence as they advance in that territory of al-Qaeda hideouts, of passports belonging to known al-Qaeda figures and so forth. So I would say that the situation in Pakistan is like night and day compared to what it was a year ago. And a lot of it is coming out of Obama's policy initiatives.
What do you think of President Obama's policy on drones? Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was just in Pakistan, and she was repeatedly asked in these sort of intimate gatherings about drones. One woman told her that using aerial drones to target terrorists amounted to executions without trial.
Yes, that is true. I'm a critic of that particular policy of Obama's, although it was also a policy that predated Obama. The problem is that there's a great deal of hypocrisy on the Pakistani side about this, because what we now know is that the Pakistani government is up to its armpits in this policy, that the drones take off from Pakistani airports, that the Pakistani government is involved in the decision-making. And so these complaints that they come out and make from time to time are completely hypocritical. The Zardari government wants those drone strikes on suspected al-Qaeda sites, and the drones strikes are a violation of international law because they are summary executions. I'm against them, but the situation is, it's not, you know, it's often depicted as imperialist power forces poor Pakistan to endure this horrible thing. Whereas I think if you knew the full story behind the scenes, President Zardari and General Kayani and so forth are deeply implicated in the policy.
And Professor Cole, you gave President Obama very high marks on Iran. Tell us about that section of your article.
Right. So for 8 years, the Bush administration absolutely refused to talk to Iran, except very briefly with regard to security in Iraq, but on a very narrow issue. At the same time, it was almost daily condemning Iran for its nuclear enrichment program and rattling sabers at Iran. I mean, poor Cy Hirsch was forced by his leaks in the Pentagon to write the same story over and over again for a couple of years about how Cheney was trying to get up an act of war on Iran. And Bush at one point sent two aircraft carriers to the Persian Gulf. There's no evidence whatsoever that any of this saber-rattling or any of this attempt to ignore Iran's existence had any effect whatsoever on Iranian policy. And if the problem from Washington's point of view was Iran's enrichment program, well, that made advances all the while that the Bush administration was there. So Obama came into office pledging to talk face-to-face with Iran, and I was delayed in this endeavor by the turmoil, political turmoil, in Iran this summer. But at Geneva on October 1st, the U.S. And the other United Nations permanent members, as well as Germany, met with a representative of the Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei, and began talking directly about what could be done about Iran's nuclear enrichment program to satisfy the West, and to avoid further economic sanctions on Iran. Also, there was the issue of Iran's second nuclear enrichment facility, which it had built in near Qom. The U.S. and the others wanted that inspected immediately. And the upshot of those negotiations was, A, the inspections have occurred. The new facility has been inspected. And there's no evidence of any nuclear activity there yet. And certainly no evidence of bomb building. Second, that some disposition be made for the disposal of Iran's low-enriched uranium. That negotiation has hit snags, and we don't know exactly where it's going to go. But it's certainly the case that there's now momentum in the talks with Iran. There's people are thinking of imaginative ways to resolve these outstanding issues. And that momentum did not exist last year. This time, in fact, the momentum was towards war.
Professor Cole, can you stay with us for just a few minutes to take two calls?
Sure.
Okay, great. Let's hear from Eben in Oakland. Hi, Eben. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I think it's really premature to give Obama certainly a finishing grade. I mean, certainly he's changed the tone, as you will, but, you know, his tactics are pretty much Bush's, you know. He doesn't rattle the sabers, but, he's a bully just like Bush is. I think in Iraq, I'd like to see our troops out of there. I've heard generals say, oh, well, we're going to stay for years and years and years in there. We can't leave because there's 18 billion barrels of oil underneath that land.
Hold that thought. Let's get Professor Cole to address that one.
Well, you know, first of all, I'm not giving him a final grade. I'm giving him an 8-month grade. So I think it's perfectly legitimate to look back on the first 8 months and say, well, you know, what has he done? What has he done that's different from Bush? What successes and failures has he had? And I'm telling you that the withdrawal from Iraq is more than on track, that it's ahead of schedule, that the foot dragging by the U.S. generals that you mentioned, which was correct, has ceased, that they now talk about faster withdrawals than they had anticipated, and the fact that there are 118 billion barrels of petroleum under the soil in Iraq is not relevant to the U.S. military presence, because the U.S. military presence is going to end. It is a treaty that has been signed between the Iraqi parliament and Washington, and there's every evidence that the U.S. is getting out of Iraq. And there are lots of countries that have lots of oil under their soil where there isn't a U.S. Big U.S. military presence. Saudi Arabia is one of them. So I know the fears that somehow that this is a parlor trick and Obama will manage to turn himself into W and suddenly start speaking with a Texan accent, and then we'll be stuck over there forever. But I'm telling you that so far that's not what we have evidence for happening.
Professor Cole, what will the U.S. presence be in Iraq when you look at the 58 bases? They are dismantling some of them. And then the $700 million embassy, the largest embassy in the world.
Rose, I grew up on military bases. None of the ones I grew up on any longer exists. Bases are fungible. You build them, you take them down, you turn them over to the host country. Those bases are not relevant to the argument. You have troops in the country, you need a base for them. Those bases are being turned over one by one to the Iraqi government. All of them will be in the end. As for the monstrosity of the U.S. embassy, the GAO and the State Department are coming back and saying it might have to be torn down, that it's very badly built, and it's anyway way too huge. And I wouldn't put a lot of money on that ever being occupied.
Well, they sure spent a lot of money to build it.
Yes, well, they spent probably altogether about $3 trillion when you count in the vet benefits that we'll be paying for the rest of their lives and so forth on this boondoggle. $3 trillion that we don't have, that we're now profoundly in debt, and we've got 10% unemployment. This was the Bush administration's big boondoggle. I mean, it is the biggest boondoggle in history. So there's enormous amounts of waste here. And what I'm telling you is that Obama, you know, has stopped digging us into that hole, and that we're now coming back out. I'm going to have to run.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us, Professor Cole.
Thanks so much for having me.
Professor Juan Cole, his latest article is in Salon.com, Obama's Foreign Policy Report Card. He says you'd never know it from the mainstream media, but he says he deserves high grades for his work so far in Iran, Iraq, and Pakistan. You can find that article at our website, yourcallradio.org. We are also joined today by Harry Kreisler, Executive Director of the Institute of International Studies at UC Berkeley. He's author of the forthcoming book, Political Awakenings. It'll be published by the New Press in March. And unfortunately, Professor Cole had to leave us early. Professor Kreisler, what are your thoughts? Let's stick with Iraq for a couple more minutes. And we still have Eben on the line who has another question. But what are your thoughts on Professor Cole's comments about the troops eventually leaving Iraq? Do you think that will happen?
Well, we'll just have to see. I think in Professor Cole's defense, where I can agree with him is that I admire Obama's stance. That is, he has started the move of troops out. Secondly, I think it's very important to emphasize again and again that the getting out of a place is very, very complicated. You don't want a sudden withdrawal, a timetable that's too quick, so that the troops aren't protected, and you essentially leave a worse chaos than we created in the first place. And I think what worries me especially is that if this isn't done correctly and in a pace that respects the realities on the ground, that you're going to create a political turmoil here at home, because the people who want out are a majority, but the center is always subject to pressure from the right that, you know, this is an American defeat and so on. And we would pay the consequences of that perception, you know, in the future. And here I'm talking about domestic politics. I do not think that Obama has been able to address the ethnic problems within Iraq. I don't think the problem of oil has been resolved. So there are just a number of issues out there that he has not been able to address because he's focused on this narrow implementation of getting the troops out. I'm not sure that I believe that bases disappear in the way that Professor Cole suggests. There may not be 58 bases when this process moves further along, and the number may decline, but there will be enough there to ensure our strategic interests in the region.
Well, and some of these bases are like mini towns. I mean, they're massive, massive
yes.
bases in Iraq. And then the 150,000 contractors are still there. I was surprised to hear Professor Cole say that that embassy might be dismantled. A report came out recently about corruption and waste, just last week, actually. But what are your thoughts on this massive embassy that's the size of the Vatican?
Well, I mean, the embassy is a product of the hubris of an empire trying to run at full blast. That was the Bush administration. From what I understand about the embassy, it's not even rational. You know, it's a lot of people making a lot of money
right.
to create a structure that sort of symbolizes our imperial presence there. And so what I would say is that I have no doubt that if there are 8 years in an Obama administration, you know, what we leave there will be of a much smaller scale. Now, the big question, the really important question, is to what extent do we actually change our policies in the region? You know, what we see our role, our global role in that region? And there, I think the answer is unclear. And so. I would just say that, you know, I respect Professor Cole for trying to see the good in what Obama is doing at this early phase in his career. I think that the problem that Obama has, and it's not clear at all how he addresses it, is how do you deal with the structural issues with regard to American global power? And to what extent can he turn the ship, you know, this huge tanker, around in the water and have a leadership for the U.S., which he articulated in the campaign? But I don't know if he'll be able to implement that.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Eben. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. We're talking about President Obama's foreign policy record so far. What do you think of what he's done specifically in the Middle East? We'll talk about other places around the globe in the future. 866-798-8255. Let's hear from Peggy in Sonoma. Hi, Peggy. Thanks for holding. Peggy, are you with us? Hi. Sorry about that, Peggy. If you're still listening, you can give us a call back. Let's go next to Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you for a good program as usual. I have some comments on Obama's failings, and really, my comments are for the left in this country. There is a great deal of frustration on the part of the left, disappointment. People were hoping to that Obama would be doing much more. But my comment is simply this. When Stalin was in power in the Soviet Union, he used to make fun of the Pope. He would say, how many divisions does the Vatican have? I'm tempted to ask the same thing about the left in this country. How many divisions does the left have? The reality of it, the left has very little traction when it comes to real power in this country. Mm. Without a lobby to push Obama in certain directions, things will not happen. Obama will simply not go there. He can only do so much, and there is a misunderstanding. I never understood that he was a socialist, a Marxist, not even a social democrat. The man is from the mainstream of the Democratic Party. What you see is what you get, so to speak. Mm. And the other point I'd like to make is that in the case of Latin America, I think the tone has changed, and it is very important. Things are much more civil with Venezuela today. I think in the case of Cuba, things are better. There is more of a dialogue. But there again, in order to see change in Cuba, we have to undo the Helms-Burton Act. And that depends on Congress. Obama alone cannot accomplish that. And I don't see the powers in Congress to achieve these things. Mm. The same thing goes for Israel, the Middle East, the Palestinian issue, Iraq, Iran, and Afghanistan. Where is the lobby on the part of the left? I don't see it.
Well, thank you for calling in, Max.
I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you so much. There was just an article, I don't remember where it is, but we'll put it on the website after the show, just about all of the anti-war rallies are sort of disappointing. So many people are not showing up. And the author of this article actually interviewed people who were interested in these rallies and actually formed these rallies years ago, but are not involved at all now because people are tired, frankly. What are your thoughts on this, Professor Kreisler? What about the left and Max's argument that they just don't have the power to push President Obama?
Well, I think there's an element of truth in what he's saying, and I think that what the left has is idealism and a way of critiquing what has come before. So the great virtue of the people in the street, the anti-war movement that emerged after the Iraq War, is a critique that one could see of what was being done with regard to the response to 9/11, and especially the part of the response that involved in invading Iraq. I think that getting back to the point about lobbying, I think there's truth in that. And so I think that the left hasn't done that work, but one doesn't know if it's doable in the context where the issues are so complicated. I think that what we have is a problem of not having a lobby that can sort of focus on the broad issue of what America's global role should be. There's no lobby there. And so what you get is people who might get activated on particular issues, the Israel-Palestine issue, the Iran issue, but not on the big picture, because the choices we make with regard to particular policies often flow from the big picture issues. And the big picture has lobbies, basically, so that we have a military establishment that sees itself as having a global role and therefore is going to push for kinds of interventions that the American people as a whole may not want.
Well, speaking of lobby, I mean, the neocons had so much power during the Bush administration. What sort of shift do you see happening, or what shift has happened in the last year? What forces are really at play in deciding U.S. foreign policy right now?
Well, I think that, you know, the answer to that question is still open. So what we have is a president, you know, it was said of Franklin Roosevelt by Oliver Wendell Holmes that he had a first-class temperament and a second-class mind. I think we have a president with a first-class mind and a first-class temperament. I think he's brought a lot of interesting people into the government. The problem is that I think there remains a consensus about America's role in the world, that we are the leader, that if things are not done by us, they don't get done, and so on and so forth. And what you see is items probably being put on the table when the president is briefed, but when push comes to shove, the question is, are they implemented? And I don't know the answer yet to that question, and I think it's a very difficult problem for President Obama, which he will have to deal with a longer interval than 1 year.
Can you give us any insights about what's happening within, say, the CIA and the Pentagon, for example? Because Cy Hirsch recently gave a speech and said that the military is waging a war with the White House. He went so far as to say the Pentagon would like to see President Obama get into trouble.
Well, I don't know what I would want to say about that. I think the way I would state this is this: let me step back a minute and make a point. If you look at where Obama seems to be disappointing, one area is in international finance, where it's very hard to understand, if you're not a Wall Street banker, you know, what's going on or why it's good for the American economy as a whole. What is the story behind that? The story behind is that international finance and international banking is a pillar of American power in the world. And it has been, and it may have imploded, but the fact of the matter is, if one is president, tends to be overly cautious about addressing those problems because it's a pillar of American power. And so that's why we're protecting the banks that are too big to fail. If you look at, well, what is the other pillar of American global power? It has to be the military. We are the one with the air power and the other kinds of power, the technology that can, we're the only country that can really move around the globe, both to aid in the face of disaster, but also to intervene. So one way to think about the military, it's not as if the military wants war, but it's everywhere. It has bases all over the globe. And I would think that the option of intervening is often more attractive, just as a general principle. And so what we have is a military that's so powerful and so global that it's hard to make the choice not to intervene.
Right. Well, and I wanted to ask you about that because the White House last week, President Obama approved the Defense Department's $680 billion budget for next year. It didn't get that much attention. And I wanted to ask you where this comes into play, because many guests we've had on the show say, without war, you don't have the money. And a lot of the contractors are filling their coffers continually over the last 8 years. So where does that play into all of this?
Well, I think Obama's got to move the tanker, you know, as it is abroad, but he also has to move the domestic situation. And that what you have is he is forced to make choices based on, you know, the interests that he's given, so to speak. And so I think that contractors are an option that seems easier when you're confronted with a situation, well, what do? We're getting out of Iraq. Who picks up the burden that needs to be picked up? I'm not defending the use of contractors. What I'm saying is that Obama's choices are affected by choices that have been made by the American government in previous administrations, especially the administration of Vice President Cheney. So what we have is Obama now. Let's look at Afghanistan. What is on the table? On the table is McChrystal's call for 40,000 more troops. And Obama is looking at all the options and so on. And, well, what will he decide? What can he decide? And it's one would say that he's approaching a decision that says, okay, I'll give you half that number of troops, and we'll put more money into development. Whether that solves this problem, this conundrum, in the long term is not clear at all. Because if you put in some troops, you're going to have to put in more.
I got about three emails on Israel and Palestine. We just got a phone call from a caller who couldn't stand the line, who wanted you to comment on the $3 billion the U.S. gives to Israel every year. And Haaretz reporter Gideon Levy wrote a piece on Sunday called America Stop Sucking Up to Israel. He said now is the time to say to the U.S. enough flattery. If you don't change the tone, nothing will change. As long as Israel feels the U.S. is in its pocket and that America's automatic veto will save it from condemnations and sanctions, that it will receive massive aid unconditionally, and that it can continue waging lethal campaigns without a word from Washington, the killing will continue.
Yeah, I think I would say two things. That column shows you that there's a vigorous political debate in Israel that may not have the impact in terms of the actual policy of Israel, but Levy's article, which I read, is not one that the Washington Post or the New York Times would publish, I bet. So I think that the case of dealing with Israel is a very good case to talk about. Obama comes in with a lot of idealism about starting negotiations, moving the peace process forward. He lays down a marker. The marker is no new settlements. Hillary Clinton goes in a previous trip to Israel and says, we mean business now. No, you know, I'm paraphrasing now, but no new settlements mean no new settlements. Okay, month or two later, she goes back. In the meantime, Israel started construction on 2,500 settlements, then added another 500. So it's now constructing 3,000 settlements. Then Hillary Clinton comes back and said she wants to compliment the Prime Minister Netanyahu for beginning to recognize the need to think about changing Israel's policy. Well, that is a case where there was a marker set by the president with regard to how things had to change, and when push come to shove, he backed down. And I think this goes back to the caller's comment, you know, where is the lobby for, you know, pushing Obama back to the original position he took?
Well, the J Street Group met last week. Another email came in about Goldstone, and they wanted you to comment on President Obama condemning that. The House is actually voting today on a resolution calling on the president and the Secretary of State to oppose any endorsement or further consideration of the report of the UN fact-finding mission.
Well, the reaction to the Goldstone report, and one should point out that Goldstone is a highly respected jurist. He was head of the Goldstone Commission in South Africa, which played an important role. Then he was involved as a prosecutor on the Rwanda war crimes, and also the Bosnia war crimes, and so on. And so he's a very well-respected international jurist, and he went and looked on the facts. He was on Moyers. You can go to Moyers' website, and he makes a very convincing case for why he concluded what he did. Well, if there is disagreement and argument about that, then I think he's open to that discussion. But what we get is, well, this is a narrative that's not acceptable. And so for quite a while, Israel said, well, we're just not going to, you know, touch this. This is, you know, this is against the state of Israel and so on. And now I think the Congress has picked up that line. And so what we're hearing here is that this narrative is unacceptable. And by the way, we should point out that Goldstone was critical also of Hamas for the missiles it was sending over to attack Israel, which was a prelude to the war.
Right.
So,
and Professor Kreisler, we're almost out of time. Final thoughts from you as President Obama decides whether to send more troops to Afghanistan, and then any foreign policy issues we should look at that maybe aren't getting enough attention?
Well, I think that not a particular issue, but rather how does America define its role in the world? And can it speak with one voice? And so, for example...
And we have about 20 seconds.
Okay. As we develop new relations with Russia, do we want the vice president making speeches that seem to go against that policy when he travels to Eastern Europe?
All right. Well, Professor Harry Kreisler, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
Professor Kreisler is Executive Director of the Institute of International Studies at UC Berkeley and author of the forthcoming book, Political Awakenings. Thanks for listening. I'll be right back to let you know what's coming up tomorrow. Can the U.S. lead at the climate conference in Copenhagen without an environmental bill? On the next Your Call, we'll discuss the key commitments the U.S. needs to make to slow global warming. And if there's no bill from Congress, will President Obama even show up? How can concerned citizens make their voices heard? Join us live at 11 a.m. or send us your questions and comments to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Can the U.S. lead on climate change? It's Your Call with Sandeep Roy and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find links there to the Your Call blog and podcast. Malihe Razazan is producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Pete Misick is our web editor. Phil Hartman is the chief engineer, and Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This Week in This American Life. James Brawley was on vacation with his girlfriend, swimming one night. She went to bed, leaving him and a beautiful French woman.
Alone, in the dark, in our underwear, in the Mediterranean, where they invented the word philander.
Stories of cheating, cheaters, and the cheated this week.
This American Live, noon tomorrow here on KALW. San Francisco Office of Emergency Services is conducting its weekly test of San Francisco's 49 air warning sirens. The test occurs every Tuesday at 12 noon and lasts approximately 30 seconds. The system is maintained by the City and County of San Francisco to alert residents to turn on the radio in the event of emergencies, such as a hazardous